back to Past a Purpose. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We are joined by a very special guest today, Mark Durand. And Mark is also a professor at Cambridge Judge Business School, where Alan is also a professor. So Alan, Mark is one of your colleagues. Why did you want to invite Mark on to Past a Purpose this week?
You'll find out when you hear him, but he is unambiguously one of the most interesting human beings I've ever met in my entire life. And one of the things that strikes me about him is the kind of work that he does is deeply immersive. And he goes places and studies human beings in places we would never venture to. And so the depth of the learning and the quality of the experiential learning that he brings to the table is beyond anything I've ever witnessed. And it reminds me, he's an extreme example of this, but when I've counseled students who are interested in trying to explore ideas for potential career paths, I've said, well, why don't you try an immersion? Why don't you go study at the source? And one of my students, as an example, ended up studying at-risk youth education in a juvenile jail in the United States and learned so much from a few weeks there that helped catapult her into other options and gain credibility and, more importantly, a lot of confidence. You know, Mark is an extreme example of that, which I call ground zero learning. And I wanted to hear his perspective on ground zero learning.
Yeah, I think that's one of the first topics that we talked about when we had first met Alan was, what do you care about and how can you get involved and how can you go learn it and see it? And I think that having someone like Mark on today really illustrates that concept and why it's valuable. And I really can't wait for everyone to hear Mark's story. So without any more waffling, let's get into it. Mark Durand is a professor of organizational ethnography at Cambridge Judge Business School. His latest book, Doctors at War, Life and Death in a Field Hospital, was published in April of 2017 by Cornell University Press. Mark studies people by living with them under similar conditions for extended periods to better understand how they experience and develop meaningful relations to the world around them. A recurring feature of his work is the variety of human experience in relatively extreme contexts, with a particular focus on how people work together to solve problems in challenging environments. His fieldwork has included prolonged stints with doctors and nurses at war in Afghanistan, boat race crews in Cambridge, adventurers on the river of the Amazon, stop the war activists on a walk from Berlin to Aleppo, and for the past 3 years, pedophile hunters. In recognition of his work, he was awarded one of only two UK Fulbright Distinguished Scholarships, which took him to Stanford, and several Best Published Article Awards from the Academy of Management, the most significant scholarly body in the field. Mark, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to Paths to Purpose.
You're super welcome.
If we could just start by having you kind of talk about, what your current role is, what it means to be a professor of organizational ethnography, and then kind of how did you get into this field and why?
Oh, wow. Thank you. I suppose to answer the last question first, it wasn't a straightforward thing, right? I feel extremely lucky actually to be where I am. I don't think, looking at what I was like before the age of 28 or something, I should have been here at all. So I'm not quite sure how I landed here. I think I just did. And I knew that I was always interested, I think, in people. And I think much like what motivates your podcast, it's the existential domain. It's why people do what they do, why they behave the way they behave. And so I've been living life vicariously, I think, through other people by kind of living with them, but as an outsider in some ways, trying to describe their world as best I could and trying to, in the description, tease out some kind of underlying themes or what I think are what motivates people to do what they do. And I quite like that. I like watching people do stuff. I don't think I'm socially particularly good, but I do like standing on the sidelines and kind of living life, as I said, vicariously. I'm quite often surprised, as are my daughters, my girls, and my partner, that I actually made it to Cambridge. You would have thought, but...
Did you hear the extensive bio that I just read and you're surprised that you made it to Cambridge?
I am, though, because it just feels like a mess of different things, I mean, there's a coherent theme, but none of it was quite carefully thought out, I think, It just interesting people, particularly people doing difficult things in difficult communities and people that I often have a lot of respect for and just trying to figure them out as best I could. It's interesting because I was thinking about Path to Purpose and I was giving this some thought beforehand and said, well, you know what, I'm not sure that actually I have much of a purpose at all, you know, and I find it a really difficult question. It's such a big chunk and it's such a heavy question. It feels like a make or break it kind of question. And so thinking about this, you know, I don't tend to think of life that way anymore. I think I used to, and it got me to all sorts of rabbit holes, I think. You know, I grew up in a very conservative religious environment, you know, as a child of missionary parents. And so the whole notion of purpose weighs heavily on one's shoulders with all the moral baggage that comes with that. And to give you an example of how conservative that community was, it was that community from which David Koresh recruited for the Branch Davidians. And two of the people I knew, including a friend of mine, burnt in Waco, Texas in 93. And I've always wondered what it was that drove people like that, people that are well-meaning, that are quite smart and completely genuine, to be persuaded to follow someone as crazy as David Koresh. I think if anything, I think what caused them to do this, I think, is just the desire to do good, to be good. You know, I don't think there's anything, I think it's all very benign, you know, on their part. These are mostly idealists. I think they're just so desperate to do something good and to make a positive difference. And what if this is all true, you know, at the end of the day? So I thought a lot about purpose when I was younger. I never really got anywhere, frankly. And then I think more recently, I've come to a very different view, which I find really liberating. And I summarized this in my emails as a signature by means of a quote that I paraphrased from Joseph Campbell. So let me kind of read the paraphrased version to you, because he says, people say that what we're all seeking is meaning for life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think that what we're seeking is an experience of being alive. And once we have that, we will suddenly find that the question of meaning ceases to be important. I think that's it. So I think let's give the purpose question a break, if that makes sense. And let's focus on what we find life-giving, the stuff that we enjoy, the stuff that makes us happy, surround ourselves with people that we think we can make a positive difference to and that make a positive difference to us. And let's cut out stuff that isn't life-giving. That is a much easier question to handle. It's a bit like differentiating between meaning and simply what feels meaningful. I think you and I know what feels meaningful to us when we're in the moment. But to talk about meaning as an existential construct is much, much harder. So I think that's where I landed. You know, I genuinely feel really, really lucky. But in terms of purpose, I don't think I will ever know. And not a day goes by when I don't ask myself whether what I'm doing now, though I enjoy it, whether it's actually what I should be doing. If you look at the war in Ukraine, for example, I envy doctors and nurses. You know, I envy people with the skills that Alan, in your past life, the very practical military stuff, being able to make a difference to people. You know, I can't. I'm the foggiest what I could do. And it frustrates me. And I don't know, I every day ask myself, should I be doing something else? And I wouldn't at all mind giving up what I do if something else came along that was more meaningful. I just haven't found it out yet. I don't think I'm good at very many things, frankly. So that makes life easier. And by the way, that reminds me of a story I wanted to tell you. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks tells. It's about an old woman. And this old woman, it was a real woman, actually. And I no longer remember her name or what she did, but she was very good at what she did. And people asked her, said, well, how did you find purpose in your life? Did doors open for you? Did one door open for you? And you suddenly knew where to go and what to do. And she said, no, that never happened. But she said, doors closed behind me all the time. And that had the same guiding effect. And I think that is true of at least my life too. You know, doors shut behind us all the time. And so that can actually also be quite a useful way of thinking about maybe what not to do. So. Sorry, I don't know if it makes sense or not, but I find a purpose question really, really tough.
I think a lot of people find it very tough. And I think that what you just said resonates very strongly with me, but I think it will with our listeners as well, because I think purpose does have this very heavy quality about it that you should be so self-aware that you can just identify it on a very short notice and you should be able to find a way to engage with it. And I think that that can have some paralyzing effects on individuals if they feel like they can't actually make any action on anything because they're scared of making the wrong step and that it does feel just like it's this big topic. And so I think what you just said makes a lot of sense. And it kind of, ironically enough, a podcast about purpose very much resonates with purpose and what the actual ethos is of purpose and kind of having a life that is finding meaningful moments and not staying on the straight line of like what you think you should be doing. So a follow-up question I have to that is, how do you know yourself when you find something that you want to engage with? It sounds like you have a very strong introspective self-awareness when it comes to kind of things that you want to engage with or projects you want to be a part of or people you want to study. How do you learn that about yourself, and how have you kind of gone about deciding where to engage?
So thank you. So I think the honest answer is that as ethnographers, we are beggars, not choosers, right? And so a lot of the stuff that we want to do, we can't do. And the reason we can't do it is because people very quickly figure out that when you hang around for a long time, you'll see all sorts of stuff and they have no control over what it is you choose to write about or not. And I think the risk is, they will think that the risk is too high. Having said that, occasionally you are let into the door, and I think that door you choose, it's one of five doors that you choose, you push against, and one opens and four stay closed. And I think these doors I do choose quite deliberately. So I'm intensely curious about the lives of people when lots of things to take for granted are stripped away. In the context of war, for example, or on the peace march, you know, when people have to live €5 a day, they will never really know where they sleep until kind of the evening comes and they just end up and sleep on a haystack or on a beach or on a church, whatever else. In the Amazon, when everything's kind of stripped away and you're a week between cities, you're in the jungle and a small boat, you can't get off. Neither of us spoke any of the useful languages either. So, I mean, you're completely lost. And I think there's something in there that really intrigues me. What happens to us, you know? And I think what happens isn't necessarily pretty. I think human beings can be very dark, and that includes myself. But there are also really nice moments. And I think you get to see the extremes, I think. And I would like to think that it hopefully helps at least me understand kind of the human spirit. You know, at the end of the day, when everything's stripped away, what's at the core of being human? What is it? I don't know that I have the answer to that. But I think when you look at people in difficult situations, I'm hoping some of that will, I'll get a chance to smoke some of that out. Yeah. So I do choose my communities deliberately, but many of them I'm lucky when I get in. Many of the things I want to do, I don't actually get to do.
So Mark, thanks for joining us. You have always been one of the most interesting colleagues I have. And so I've been wanting to have this conversation for a long, long time with you. So I appreciate this. I want to reflect briefly on this notion of purpose, because that is really interesting to me. I think the core elements of what I heard from you, which I have recommended in others, is it has to come from basically choosing a path that comes intrinsically from inside and that has emotional resonance. And with you, that's very clear that you're choosing your own path. You're not taking too much input from outside. It's more, what do I feel I need to do? You're listening primarily to your internal compass, and it has definitive emotional resonance. I think one of the problems with business education, particularly when we're working with undergraduates, is we train the emotional resonance away. And that's a problem for me. And that's something that I wanted to bring out. With respect to kind of what you've done, though, what fascinates me the most is, from my perspective, the degree of ridiculously high risk that one would think about with immersing in an Amazonian trip, or immersing with pedophile hunters, or immersing particularly in an Afghanistan combat environment. Can you talk a little bit about how you think about risk in the decisions that you're making?
I don't think I think about it all that much, actually. I think that's helpful, I think. There's something that appeals in risky environments, which is, it makes one feel alive, if that makes sense, right? It doesn't always work, but I think that's part of what I hope is going on. To do stuff or to put yourself in environments that are maybe a little bit edgy just brings you a little bit closer to feeling alive. I think feeling alive is really important to me, probably because I spend so much time in my head. You know, it's kind of the opposite of that. So, I mean, I have to say that the environments, you know, they may seem more risky to an outsider than they feel to me. They don't feel that risky to me. I mean, the Amazon was actually really risky, and we had no idea how risky it was. Not because of the piranhas and so on. It's the piracy and the narcotics trafficking. And ultimately, we ended up taking on board with us a mercenary. It's a guy who, he told us he'd already killed 30 people. He had 2 bullet entry hole wounds in his abdomen, and everyone told us he was hard as nails, and in a traditional kind of Hollywood way, he didn't really say very much. But it came a point where he wanted to kill me, and I was really scared. I would have stood no chance at all. Now, you see, he might have just said that and not meant it, but you know, he certainly was capable of it. He was I found him a very scary individual. And in fact, we became more afraid of him than of the pirates than he was there to keep us safe. So that was risky, but we hadn't really thought through the risk very carefully at all. And Afghanistan didn't feel risky to me. I've got to say, I mean, the first week, I've got to say, I didn't really sleep. And I think it's because of the helicopters. You know, it's so noisy. And helicopters are always bad news because it means people have gotten injured. And that, I found that quite hard, I suppose. But it wasn't fear as such. It was just the disturbing, you know, the reality. It's a side of human nature. The stuff that's unfolding in Ukraine today, that's just so ugly. It's just nasty. It's brutal. It shouldn't be happening. It's just, it's interesting. I mean, what you said early on, Alan, I found intriguing sort of the fact that the work we do, or some of the work that we do, and I think your work is part of that too, particularly your work with students and the path to purpose and so on, it has to resonate with an internal compass, and I think that's true. I would take it a step further. I think some of the best work we do, or we're likely to do as academics, is the work that is most personal to us. Now, that seems to tick all the wrong boxes because we must be objective, yada, yada, yada. But I think generally, I think if we do work that we feel strongly about as human beings, that resonates with something inside us, you know, that evokes an emotional response inside us, I think it could be or is likely to be some of the most powerful work we'll ever produce. And that's the work we should be producing. And so I hear you when you talk about our undergraduates. I'd take it even further than that. I think even with our PhD students, you know, the kind of work that they've been socialized into thinking they should be doing. And how, I sad to say, you go to conference, how uninteresting so much of it is. And I don't think I find it uninteresting. I think they find it uninteresting. But it just feels like this is what they can slice into papers and that sort of tenure and stuff. And say, well, I'm lucky because, you know, Ellen and I, we can speak from a position of luxury. I'm aware of that. But I just kind of wish that people would just focus on stuff they feel strongly about. It might be a little bit incoherent, but they just know. You know, if they get it right, it's going to make a difference. You know, just do that instead. Life is short, you know.
With respect to this, the learning that you're doing, let me go back. I have an advisor when I was doing my doctoral work who had said to me something that shook my system at the time. And she said, be prepared to be the world's expert on your topic when you leave. And I didn't think that was possible, but then I started observing people like you doing immersive work and how a month, I forget how long you were in Afghanistan. You were there a considerable amount of time at...
I was there, yeah, for a tour of duty for surgeons, which is 6 weeks. And then there was like a 16-month period leading up to that.
So, I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that you arguably are one of the most sophisticatedly knowledgeable people in that space, which is why you were able to write a book and talk about it with such clarity. Can you reflect on that? Like, how much value the immersive experience does with respect to learning? Because I try to tell students, if they really want to understand something, they should go to ground zero and study it at ground zero under the assumption that it's safe. I mean, I don't want to steer somebody down a path where it's inherently dangerous. So maybe they shouldn't listen to you. But what's the value of the learning in this immersive work that you're doing?
I think it's invaluable, you know. And that is why I think when I started doing field work, ethnography in 2005-06, I don't think I've ever wanted to do something else. And I think I just can't go back to doing interviews. And there's nothing wrong with doing interviews versus using surveys. But I think the learning, the stuff that you get out of it is very, very different, right? So the big downside with immersive learning is that you can't really generalize from what it is you pick out for obvious reasons, right? These are samples of one. But you get to see a level of detail that I think is very, very special. And I also think that it's really hard in interviews or particularly, say, survey settings to get past the sales pitch, past people behaving in a way they think they would like you to behave, give you the answers they think would benefit your work, as opposed to immersive work where you hang around for so long that you kind of become part of the furniture. You know, no one cares either way. And that's why it's important to be around for a long time. I mean, even in Afghanistan, I knew the people that I deployed with quite reasonably well because we'd met so many times in the 16 months leading up to this, you know, for training, exercise, and so on. And so you kind of just hang around. They used to poke fun of me all the time, you know. And then you kind of become part of the furniture, you know, and no one, that is when people start to behave in ways, they start to behave more naturally, you know, letting their hair down. And I always find that extremely privileged, even when they start opening up to you, you know, about issues they can't easily talk about with someone else. But because you're a little bit of an outsider, they feel like you're a good sounding board. And sometimes I just find it incredibly privileged to be in the listening end of that. So I think in immersive learning, I think there's something about it that you just can't get any other way. And I'm with you entirely, Ellen. It may not be for everyone, but I would say if you can do it, if you have the opportunity to do it, absolutely go ahead and do it. You know, it brings you really, really close to another human being. Now, that has all sorts of consequences, which are really troublesome in research. For example, you know, you're starting, and this is a horrible way to put it, but it's almost like you're starting to weaponize your humanity, where you build relationships that are important to your research. But at the end of the day, it pays to maintain those relationships because of the quality of the research likely to come out of it at the other end. And then when you start writing up the research, it's almost always the case that some people see the world differently than you do, and they will find that you've betrayed them because maybe you've made public something they told you they thought would be kept private but never said so to you, something like that. You know, I try to be really careful, but I think because people see the world differently and because people forget that you're around and so they say things, do things that they wouldn't do in front of a camera, the publication part, I think, you find very, very difficult. I published a piece yesterday, a short piece on the pedophile hunting research, and I held my heart, you know, thinking what the pedophile hunters might think about this, you know, and the risk is you start self-censoring. Fortunately, the response so far was okay, but actually, it's interesting because quite often the people I've written about have been okay with what I've written. It's usually the powers that be that take real issue with what comes out of it. So, no, I'm all for immersive work, but I would say that, you know, that's kind of what I do. But I could never go back to anything else. I just would rather just quit academia.
I have so many thoughts after everything you just said. And I'm thinking back to the beginning of our conversation and how you mentioned that you wish that you had more skills such as doctors and nurses or like Alan's background in military because of their ability to help. And I find that really interesting because I think the work that you do and that other ethnographers do is so invaluable because it connects people that don't have the ability to do what you just said that you can do, which is go into these communities and to shed light on lived experiences that are maybe vastly different than the readers. And so I think that's just a very interesting juxtaposition that I'm seeing in kind of our discussion today, is like your perceived maybe value on like what helping people that are in these war situations are versus like sharing the lived experiences with a broader audience. And I guess my question that I have from that is kind of, how do you work through some of those fears that you might have, like you just said, that you're experiencing when you're sharing someone's life in one of your books or their most intimate experiences and with the article that you published, you know, the response that you might get? How do you work through kind of, or do you have fears with how you're representing others? And the weight of your work to me just feels so important, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And maybe this is a poorly worded question, but it's that idea of just, it really does seem so non-trivial, all of these things that you're bringing to people's attention. And so how do you kind of work through the weight of that?
So good question, right? So I'm not sure that I do a good job at it. I try, but I always worry that I don't get it right. It reminds me a bit of what you just said, Ellen, about your PhD supervisor telling you that you're expected to be an expert in your field, in your subject. And I'm just wondering, I mean, thinking, I don't know about you, Ellen, do you feel like an expert? I'm not sure that I do, actually, because, you know, sometimes I'm reminded of this really wonderful metaphor of our knowledge being like an island. And as our knowledge grows, the island grows. If you look at the islands, you know, the island is surrounded by the sea, and our sea is our ignorance. So as the island grows, our knowledge grows. Then so does the boundary grow between the island and the sea, if that makes sense, right? And so it's like the ignorance grows with the, or the awareness of the ignorance grows with the island growing, with the knowledge growing. I think that's kind of how it is. So I don't know that I always get it right. I think it's really nice when people tell you later on that they've read your work and they're in that field and they say, they kind of tell you that they've got it right. That's, for me, is a real relief. that is kind of a validation that I love to have, you know, not from academics, but from the people I'm trying to write about. It's just a story from a particular point of view. In terms of how I work with the weights, it does feel heavy. And I think part of what I try to do is to compensate making other people look like human beings by just owning up to my own stuff. The reason I write myself in my books isn't because it's something I enjoy doing. It's because I think it's the honest thing to do. It's methodologically honest, because then at least you can draw some conclusions about why I might have written what I wrote. But also because I can compensate only by making myself vulnerable for having made other people vulnerable, you know. So I don't think I always come out looking that great, you know, but that's fine.
I had a few thoughts on the expert issue because it weighed very heavily on me, and I thought it was a pretty big burden. And I realized that the goal isn't necessarily to be the expert on the topic. The goal is to be intrinsically curious enough to explore it more than other people might, and to be able to help inform the discussion around it. And that's where I think I find myself inherently much more curious about some issues. And you and I have discussed many of them. For example, disinformation is one that's near and dear, and we've had a lot of conversation around that. So rather than saying I'm going to be the expert on it, I'm going to be curious enough to explore it with considerable depth. And that's where I see things like your immersive learning to be very valuable as one way to approach it.
I like that a lot. I hadn't thought about that before, but I like that it's a commitment to curiosity in some sense, right?
Yeah, I think that's sort of taking some of the burden off of trying to be the expert in the room. And actually, just pedagogically, what I've started to do now is I've started to introduce curriculum where I literally know nothing so that I can learn. So I become part of the selfishness around the curriculum. And that includes some of the sustainability projects that we've started and even the disinformation. I have so many questions around it that I wanted to bring in people who I would consider to be experts to inform me on it, to help the learning. And in doing so, then we can broaden the collective learning. So that's sort of how I see our role here.
I have a question for the perspective of our listeners who, again, this podcast is for, you know, young people that are trying to choose a career that is meaningful to them. And I sit here in awe of all of the things that you have gotten to do in your career and kind of the impact that you have had. And I'm wondering what advice you would have for people who want to go out and learn from ground zero and who want to engage in this meaningful deep learning, but they don't know where to start. That's the question that I have for you, is where would you start if today you didn't have any of the experience that you had and you were looking for a way to be immersed and to kind of pick something and go off and do it?
So thank you. It's another good question, right? So I think the good news is that that's how most ethnographers begin, with nothing at all. I mean, Cambridge University didn't teach ethnography until only a few years ago as a methods course. And the anthropology department is actually quite well known. So I think ethnographers typically have just simply learned by going and just doing it. I don't think there's a one way, one best way to do it. So if you want to do ethnography today, just go out soon, go to a shopping mall, wherever you want to go, some interesting place, and just watch people for a while. Just try and write a cultural description of what you think you're seeing, you're looking at. I think that's it. You know, it's and then you learn from mistakes. That's how I learn. And there isn't much more to it. It's not like statistics where you take a course and you become quite fluent in statistics and then you kind of start working with numbers for real. And it's not like that. It's the kind of the opposite of that. You just dive in a deep end and just try and swim. And I think that's both the beauty and the curse, I think, of ethnography. That's what makes it very difficult, but also very beautiful. Because what you're doing is you're keeping in mind not only what it is you see, but also what's happening to you as you immerse yourself in the field. And so sometimes we talk about keeping field notes and keeping head notes. So the field notes are what I see people do. So I can say, Danielle, I see you at 2:15 today. I see you doing this, and you tell me you're doing that. And these are the kind of props you use to do what you do. The head notes are what I'm thinking about as I'm watching you. And it's me reflecting upon what's happening to me as a human being, how it's changing me as best I can. I even write down my dreams, because I think they're a great way to try and identify countertransference, you know, where I might be ascribing emotions to you, like anxiety, that actually aren't part of you at all. They just happen to be part of me. And they show up really nicely in dreams. And so I kind of keep three different diaries at the same time. And it's actually really simple in some way. It's simple, but it's not. But it's just about diving in the deep end. Don't worry too much. Don't try and go in with a research question prepared. You know, come in with a sales pitch, because people ask you what you're doing and just think of something you can tell them in 2 minutes or less that will get them out of the way. And then be patient, just spend time and see what tickles your fancy, what feels intuitively interesting. And just go with that. There's no more science to this part of ethnography. There's more to it when it comes to the analysis of the data. The thing initially is just go and do it. You know, don't wait, just do it. And read ethnographies, you know, just read some of the classic works in ethnography and see how other people have written up the experiences.
Do you enter into this with any kind of policy idea? Any idea around policy or wish that this learning will accomplish some sort of regime change, policy change, thinking change, or anything like that? Or are you just clean in reporting it as is? And if so, why? Why would you go in without policy implications?
Yeah, I don't think I go in with policy implications. I don't think I have the tools to do that. I don't know. That seems so big. Having said that, I do try and make a difference. So with the pedophile hunting stuff, I've been working with a task force in the UK. They comprise the chiefs of police, the Home Office, the National Crime Agency, the Crown Prosecution Service. So it's a formidable body. And I've been informing them from my work. And I don't know if that will make any difference. But I show up twice a year to their meetings and give presentations and stuff. And I'm kind of hoping it will. That'd be lovely. But I don't think that I'll ever see what, if any, difference it makes. I'm not sure. I think my first job is to try and describe as best I can. When it came to the Doctors at War book, which the doctors actually wanted me to write, it wasn't really my idea. They wanted me to write something that people could read and that might help other people to understand a little bit of their world. And I do think I wrote a book partly because I was angry. I was frustrated. And I wanted people to get maybe a little bit closer to the experience of war. I remember when we were there, David Cameron came along. He was the Prime Minister of the UK at the time, and he came for a visit. And it was one of those days where nothing was happening, which is really rare. And it's usually good news because people aren't getting injured. And so he came to the hospital, and there wasn't really very much going on. I mean, there was no one being operated on for the few minutes he was there. And many of us were sort of saying, well, I wish you were here yesterday. I mean, it looks like a slaughterhouse, you know, there's like all the blood on the floor everywhere. It's just really, really pretty horrid. And these are people, I mean, this is happening on their watch. And this one chance we had to show him what war is like, we kind of missed it. Because he happened to come on the wrong day, so to speak, you know. So I think part of what I try to do in the book is to give voice to the doctors and nurses, and maybe to some extent my own experience, just making people realize what's happening on their watch in other parts of the world. I don't know if I succeeded, but yeah. So I think I'm not apolitical in that sense, but I don't think I can. I'm not policy-driven. It's too big a thing for me. I don't know what it would look like. I don't know how I would do that. There's something interesting, though, that you reminded me of, Alan. So sometimes I wonder to what extent our research chooses us rather than we it, if it makes sense, right? So if I look at the last study with the pedophile hunters, it was only when I was doing the fieldwork already that I came to find out stories within my own family of sexual abuse and within my circle of friends that I hadn't been aware of, and people only started talking about this because they learned of the work I was doing. It was only then that I found out that my daughter had been, we put her in a ballet school in Scotland. She was a full-time ballerina. She was 16 at the time, 15, 16. Having danced since she was 6 years old, to find out that the vice principal of the school, the son of the woman who ran the school, had been sexually grooming and abusing the girls for 14 years. And people had kept quiet about it, even though it was an open secret. And I asked myself, I said, well, how come I've been doing this research and I've been completely oblivious to the fact that my daughter, she now tells me, had been afraid every day for a year that he might do something to her. And of course, he touched up all the girls, you know, but then it's very hard to tell the difference between what a teacher should do and what is entirely inappropriate. So it's interesting, you know, because then you think, well, why am I doing this work in the first place? It wasn't my first choice, but all this stuff is starting to happen around me that make me so much more aware of how close this stuff is. I mean, when it came to the rowers, I started with the Cambridge rowers and then, of course, the military. These are very masochistic, macho environments, very male-dominated. The rowers, they're all kind of alpha males, very tall, physically good specimens and so on. And I think it was a friend of mine who asked me some years later, say, well, why do you study men? And I never really thought about that. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Because actually, I'm much more comfortable with women than I'm with men. Always have been. You know, I've always felt kind of awkward around men. And I think I now know why. I think it's because my father is very kind, but very unlike the typical man. And I think I just never really figured out what it means to be a man in the more archetypal sense. And so, I wonder to what extent maybe our research chooses us, actually. It's not really us choosing them, or we may think we do, but the real reasons are quite a bit more complex than that. So
I do want to be cognizant of your time today and just thank you for coming on and sharing your stories, your perspective, your work with us and with our listeners. And before we kind of hand things off, do you have anything that you want to share where people can find your books, your articles, more about your work, if they're curious to learn more?
I think it's very easy to Google me, but I think there are much better books to read. You know, so much interesting. So I think you asked me a question in an email a week or so ago, what I would recommend people to read, any books or whatever else. And I thought about this and I didn't really have, there's so many good books. You know, I think my recommendation would be for anyone, go and find stuff that's really, really beautiful. It could be art. It could be this wonderful documentary called Jiro's Dreams of Sushi. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's this obsession with sushi. Or read books by Vivian Gornick or Joan Didion, James Baldwell, David Foster Wallace. You know, really extraordinarily beautiful, interesting works. And the reason why is because it shows you what compassion and dedication to something you really love doing can produce. If that makes sense. You know, and those are just examples, you know.
Oh, I love that.
Don't read self-help stuff.
Well, thank you so much for giving us some of your time today. And we really appreciate the opportunity. And with that, we will see everyone next week. Thanks for listening. This episode was made possible by our audio engineer, Jack Booth, and our growth strategist, Mikey Lulo. For more resources and inspiration on finding your purpose, check out our Instagram @PathsToPurposePod. We'll see you next time. Bye.